This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 2nd of April 2013, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up over the next hour, we drop in on the latest member of the Monocle family to open her doors, our brand new cafe down the road on Chilton Street.
The idea is that we keep our basement for subscribers, reservations, morning business meetings, etc, etc, but something a little bit more exclusive used.
We sit down with Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, to talk about the importance of working with your hands.
They just allow your mind to switch off. It's nice to be close to the material again and think about the shape of the door when you're repainting it and looking at the mouldings and taking time to remove the brass and polishing it and putting it back on.
Elsewhere, we hear about a high-flying collaboration between Fabergé and VistaJet. We drop in on a new exhibition of ambitious Middle Eastern design, and we get a tour of London-based studio Martin Brudnitsky too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D. We begin this week's Section D at a pioneering new exhibition in the heart of London. Despite its long history of conflict, the Middle East is proving fertile ground for the region's blossoming art and design scene. Exhibiting for the first time in the UK, Israeli designers Noam Dover, Michel Cederbaum and longtime collaborator Yoav Arushez have created a series of crafted objects that explore the complexities of social issues that have divided the region for generations. We dispatched Monocle's Josh Fennett to 19 Greek Street in London's Soho to meet some of the designers and talk to curator Mark Peridis about how the Designing the Middle East exhibition is attempting to open a dialogue through design.
I'm actually of Middle Eastern descent, so I've always had a big interest in the Middle East, and I visited the Middle East quite a bit, and I just kind of visiting both parts of the spectrum, both from the Israeli side and from other parts like Lebanon and Egypt. I mean, you notice that within the fact that there's a conflict, there's still also a lot of similarities between the two cultures. And the biggest similarity is kind of like the passion that these people have. You know, they live in very difficult landscapes, and they grow up in these very difficult landscapes. So they kind of grow up in a very emotional and turbulent environment, both of them. So in a way, I think that leaves a very interesting impression on a person. It was important for me to show that the result of that is the same at the end of the day, that the passion that lives in these two sides of the cultures is the same one. And when it is reflected in design, it actually comes up with very similar kind of forms and similar aesthetics, similar thinking with processes on both sides of the spectrum, even though both of them can't communicate with each other, really. You know, they somehow there's a communication happening in design and in art. So the idea here was to try to unite both cultures in the same exhibit, in the same show, and to try to bring them together where otherwise it wouldn't be possible.
In your opinion, does good design have a capacity to unite people with obviously very different opinions, very different political opinions, and a long history of division? Is there any sense that good design could be a kind of a sounding board for dialogue?
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, I think that that was the point of this exhibit, was to show people that, you know, design obviously has a very frivolous and superficial side, as we all know. I mean, this is what we see in the mainstream, but there is a side that's a lot more emotional and passionate and healing, and I think that that's the side that we're bringing in here. I think that there even was a situation where our Tel Aviv designers in Design Miami sold a piece to somebody that was actually from Lebanon or Syria, which was basically their first piece that they sold in the exhibit, was actually somebody that was from Lebanon or Syria. So that's already started to happen, regardless of whether or not it was the intention, because you know the references are there, they're the same, and the person felt a specific connection to it. So I think that it is in a way to unite the two cultures, but it's also to, you know, somehow express something to people who are not part of this conflict. People in the UK, people in France, people in the rest of Europe who don't maybe understand the magnitude of what's happening in this country, in these countries, but to see firsthand through an expression through design what is happening in this part of the world. But also not just seeing what we see in the media, which is all the destruction and all the sadness and the death, but also seeing the beauty that emerges through all of this, you know, the beauty that comes from all the passion, the loyalty that exists in these environments. You know, this is the only part of the world where people are willing to risk their lives for their beliefs. Nowhere else do we see that to such an extent. And that's huge. That's a tremendous amount of courage, of passion, of love that these people display. And this is what we're showing through the design.
I'm Noam Dover. This piece is made with a director and designer, Amit Rory, which is not with us here. He's still in Israel today. And it's a robotic bowl, which is kind of absurd, I guess. And what it does, it has a few sensors and some motor to it. And it opens up to a bowl as you get close to it. And then if you go away from it, it shuts down again to kind of a slice of a bowl. It has this specific sound to it. And when it's full, there is also a sensor here in the middle that fills the content and makes it stay as a bowl and not dance this crazy dance all the time. Of course, it's usable, but it's not really for use for everyday life, I guess, or a normal bowl.
So what's the idea behind it?
Yeah, it's a kind of clash between this hacking, emerging hacking culture and making cultures together that we're dealing with also in a few other works here in the space. You can see all the robotics elements are out there. They're not covered in any other way, or it's all very much there. And it's robotic systems that are added to 3D printing techniques. So it's actually trying to hack production techniques that are high production techniques and kind of claim them back in order to be able to do our own technical design or technological design.
What's the significance of the fact that the mechanism's uncovered? I mean, to some extent, a lot of product design features things which actually try and hide the technology behind it. Why has the decision been to leave it open?
Yeah, because I guess when you buy a product, that all the mechanisms and the electronics are hidden inside because they are uniformed with the product. They are a one thing. But here, all the robotics is kind of hacking an element and growing on it, kind of like a outside grow. It stays out there, you know, for you to see and understand this idea. They are not unified as one object. They are actually two elements living together, influencing one another.
My name is Yoav Reches. I'm a product designer. I've been working with the other designers for several years, collaborating every once in a while, doing new pieces together. The piece that is exhibited here, we call it a Saj table. Saj is a dome made out of iron that is usually used to cook pita bread, and I would say local Middle Eastern cultures use it on a daily basis. And here we try to collect these pieces, unify them into in a composition. They are combined geometrically in such a way that they create a tabletop, a very elaborated pattern of circles that has the capacity to contain liquid or any content which we would like to add to it.
And could you tell me a little bit about how it's manufactured, how you go about making it?
Since this product that we manipulated, the Saj, is bought at the side of the road, we've decided about the composition, and then we very carefully marked the connection between the pieces. So we lay down the pattern in a two-dimensional drawing, and then we decide which pieces we should cut, and they should intersect with the other pieces. And slowly, an object or Each saj is being cut into to fit the other pieces, so you will have a unification or a combination of several of them. We're looking at a combination of 9 pieces, and you see that we've also added a glass piece which is casted into that cavity to represent the similarity to water laying down in one of the cavities. So it's a little bit like a small puddle. Interesting maybe to add is that the legs are also made out of recycled, or not really recycled, but we are picking up old furniture and we are chopping it down and reassembling it. It's a clash of cultures because the Saj is very much orientated to Arabic society and not necessarily Israeli. And the structure that supports it, the legs, is actually made out of old Israeli furniture that is no longer relevant in terms of the design language. And we buy it in flea markets and we assemble it to fit this clash of cultures in, we hope it's a clash of cultures in one piece.
That was Yov Ruchez talking to our Josh Fennett there. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Section D. Still to come, we'll be talking trains, planes and drains in the UK and dropping into Monocle's brand new cafe to hear how it all came together. But now we fix our wandering eye on Madrid. Our correspondent there, Liam Aldus, met with a couple of local textile designers tucked away in their studio to talk about their own exquisite brand, Saturno. Both Julia Vergara and Javier Gutierrez Bayo bravely left their respective professions 5 years ago to focus exclusively on their colourful, geometric and often nostalgic textile designs, many of which hark back to the 1920s and 30s or have been inspired by the rural designs of old. Their decision has paid off, with collaborations with Marc Jacobs, Baum and Federgarden, Danish label Norse Projects and even Zara Home, allowing the couple to adopt a more long-term approach to design, creating timeless prints and supporting local production at the same time. The two were hard at work over the Easter break, but kindly took a few moments to talk to Liam Aldus here for Section D.
We started 5 years ago after quitting from our previous jobs. Julia was working as an architect in Alicante and I was working as art director for a PR company in Madrid. And we felt at some point it was not what we really wanted to do and we thought of starting something else run by ourselves. That's how we set up Saturno. But then we also thought of producing personal projects that we really feel like doing for no commercial reason. And eventually these projects end up becoming scarves collections.
How did your previous skill sets apply to textile design? How did you make that jump?
Repetition and geometry is something Julia was very familiar with. And in my own case, graphics was my job, basically. And both worlds meld together quite well and apply perfectly for the print design. I have the computer skills and the technical skills to produce printed pieces of fabric with our designs. Although we tend to work mainly with hand-drawing techniques in the very beginning and only bring the stuff to the computer at the very end of the process.
I ask Julia to describe the inspiration for Saturno's very first design. It's a geometric amalgamation of colourful houses printed on a silk scarf and garnered them plenty of attention, especially from other labels in Denmark and buyers as far away as Japan.
This is a composition of small overlapping houses, playing around with textures and a range of very natural colours. The colour of the roof tiles are brown, aubergine, orange, pink, which together form a camouflage effect. The good thing is that when it comes to matching it with your outfit, it combines quite easily. We are always very much influenced by texture, and this design from afar looks like geometric shapes. You can't tell exactly what they are, but when you take a closer look, you realise that they're small houses.
Blondel se llama la una de las últimas colecciones.
Blondel is the name of our latest summer collection. It reflects on the great economic crisis that occurred in 1929 and an interesting trend that emerged from it. How, curiously, the sale of bright red lipstick increased at the time, a little remedy of sorts for the bad times, perhaps. And today we realize that the same thing is occurring with nail polish. So this print mixes this whole concept with a touch of surrealism and is influenced by Man Ray and fashion designer Schiaparelli. We're using them as small modules to create texture, and from there comes two different patterns, one with hands and another with lips.
So how did it take off? Because obviously you had a few really successful designs, but how did you launch out of Spain? Because I understand most of your success has been outside of Spain.
Yeah, that's true. We started with no budget at all, but we were very lucky because we were approached by Marc Jacobs, but well, not himself, but people from his team, when they spotted a bag Julia designed as a joint project with another local brand. And this project was about redesigning a old piece of fabric that was actually used as a rack in the 50s, I would say. And Julia did a few changes in the original pattern of the sack and ended up being a really nice tote bag using this original fabric and also some other traditional fabrics from Spain. They spotted this tote bag and asked us to produce a limited series for their stores in the States that sold out within a week. So that was a very good beginning for us to attract the attention of some magazines and blogs and stuff. And that's how our brand took off in the very beginning. We suddenly got some media attention, and eventually that drove us into new clients.
Sí, pues este es una colección de cojines que llamamos espiga.
This is a collection of cushions we call espiga. They came about from using a traditional Spanish fabric, which is made from twill, which has the form of zigzag-shaped spikes. It was widely used in rural areas for bags, as sacks for the removal of the harvest. And so what we've done is to redraw the herringbone pattern by drawing the weft threads by hand, and this creates a sort of illusion. Subsequently, what we have is the concave drawing stitched on with just cotton, forming a sequence of three herringbone patterns. One is simple, and the others become increasingly complicated.
Saturno is also one of the growing numbers of designers supporting local production and the Made in Spain mantra.
Yeah, it's more about ethics for us, because sometimes it's not even cheaper, well, most of the time it's not cheaper or easier to produce locally than somewhere else. So we believe we have to support our community in order to create the right environment for every business to have a certain success. So that's one of the reasons for using local suppliers. Also, we don't want artisan traditions to be forgotten. So we also try to get the help of local artisans in the production of our items. That's very important for us.
Would you say that it's a way of investing in the long term, particularly in your line of business in the textile industry?
Yeah, that's right in a way. That's especially important now when in most areas people seem to think short term rather than medium or long term. And for us, it's not a decision that we'll probably get a profit out of it or we'll see the benefits of in the short term. But we really believe that by acting like this, by working with local suppliers, we'll help to eventually create a better Spain, in a way.
That was Julia Vergara and Javier Gutierrez Bio talking to our Liam Aldous there. You're listening to Section D. Coming up, we'll hear from Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, why working with your hands is one of life's greater pleasures. After this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Section D, and we're joined in the studio now by Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. Richard, thank you as ever for coming in.
Welcome.
I wanted to drag you down to the studio in production week because next week is the annual Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair, which celebrates global furniture manufacturing industry. And from the invitations and press releases that have been flooding into my inbox and desk, it seems that there is a big emphasis at the moment on the industry and working with your hands. And I thought maybe this was something that you have an opinion or two on that you'd like to share with the listeners of Section D.
Yeah, I mean, I think so many of us in modern life use our tools of work, our keyboards, our, you know, using a mouse, using a monitor. And it's a bit sterile, I think. And I think working with your hands is a bit more therapeutic. And I think when you work with your hands, when you're, for example, working with wood, your daily work will have, you'll use more of your senses, I think. There'll be more sound to it. There'll be more of a smell to working with wood. There's a lovely, whenever you walk into a wood shop, you know, you're instantly assorted with like very nice aromas. I think when you walk into a nice office, even a very nice office with nice wooden oak furniture, there isn't many sensory kind of delights there. You know, keyboards these days are silent. We haven't even got nice typewriters to kind of bang on. Mice are, you know, silent. Mobiles are, they don't even have keys anymore. Everything is just a sheet of glass. And I think we've just sort of drifted into this world where nothing's kind of, yeah, everything's kind of this one note feeling. Whereas I think doing something manual is a bit more solitary and a bit more, yeah, therapeutic.
And you have a much greater emotional connection, yeah, to both the designer, but also even if you don't know if something has been made by hand or has been churned out of a machine, you can sort of tell that there is a greater depth that is very difficult to put your finger on from, say, a chair that has been made by hand in a workshop compared to something that has been injection moulded at the push of a button.
Yeah, and I think you can see the design of something that's been injection moulded. It's almost like that the technology defines the design. So you see a lot of furniture lately that's been made on sort of CNC cutting machines, and you kind of get the impression that a designer's just done that on CAD and got nowhere near the material and just sort of, it's almost like he sent it to print and then it comes out the other end and, yeah, it's that's quite clever. But it hasn't got much personality, not as much personality or warmth as something that's, you know, handcrafted.
And everybody always talks about this sort of pleasure of the imperfections from something that has been made by hand as well.
Yeah, and I think something that's been designed to last and to age and to wear well, you know, like a pair of your favourite jeans, you know, if you photographed them when you first bought them, they'd be dark, and then 10 years in, you know, they're kind of bleached and worn and a bit threadbare and frayed at the hems, but, you know, they are all the better for it. And I think that's something that you kind of do lose when you're kind of looking at sort of manufacturing techniques.
Now, I'd say that in terms of the furniture industry, people returning to working with their hands is very much, I wouldn't say last resort, but in the absence of funds for manufacturers being able to commission as many designs as they were, say, 10 years ago, it's one way of designers being able to regain control for themselves, that they can actually produce things themselves. They might not be knocking out 1,000 chairs, it might only be 5. Those 5 carry a far greater price. But in terms of yourself, you obviously sit in front of a computer the whole time. Your work is very much computer-based. When you go home, do you get out your lathe and start knocking up something by hand?
I actually thought about it a couple of years ago. I don't know if it was a midlife crisis, but I did start thinking about how I could make vases out of hunks of wood, and I even went into investigating lathes and stuff like that. No, I don't yet whittle anything on my weekend. I do a bit of gardening. In fact, my hands are a little bit sore because I dug up the garden yesterday, and again, it's just a little bit therapeutic to get out and to do something different. And it's almost spiritual, I think, without trying to get too kind of religious about things. But when you're kind of doing some of these manual jobs, I don't really know what you're thinking or what's going through your head. And you can kind of spend half an hour doing something and then get to the end of that and think, what was I just thinking about? And you don't. You just sort of, it's almost like you're in a trance. You just kind of drift off and do something. And it's actually, that is quite a rare state yeah. for you to be in sort of modern life, just sort of calmly going about your way.
And meditative.
I think everyone should do that. And I think people shouldn't be scared of doing some sort of minor DIY or repairing or a bit of gardening. I mean, I don't think people should just, you know, dismantle their kitchen tap for the sake of it. But I think, you know, restoring something, rubbing down an old piece of furniture, repainting a door, all those things, actually, they just allow your mind to switch off. And you get, I think it's quite nice to be close to the material again and think about the shape of the door when you're repainting it and looking at the mouldings and taking time to remove the brass and polishing it and putting it back on, I think.
Getting closer to the things that you live with.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It is a hard thing to kind of pin down, but I just know that in the past when I've done things like that, it's been very satisfying.
Well, Richard Spencer-Powell, Monocle's Creative Director, thank you very much for dropping in. Now, the word infrastructure can result in negative reactions when brought up at the dinner table. It certainly doesn't have the allure of fine art or the intellectual kudos of architecture. However, the planning and completion of our infrastructure is something that affects nearly every aspect of our daily lives. From the most sublime feat of human engineering to the way we dispose of our city's waste, a new exhibition at London's New London Architecture Centre tries to celebrate countless new tunnels being bored, stations being redeveloped, and railways being linked in London right now. The show, aptly called Trains, Planes and Drains, brings together the hundreds of current and planned projects and the hundreds of billions of pounds of investments they represent. But how do designers fit in? Monocle's David Pleasant went along to find out. Among the first people he met was Steve Norris, the former Transport Minister for the UK and long-time Better Infrastructure advocate.
I've been involved in transport infrastructure and infrastructure projects generally for more than two decades. And I've been fascinated by the significance of infrastructure to any growing urban area and how in the UK we have an almost unique talent for making it difficult to build that infrastructure. We have a treasury that's historically been very skeptical about the value of infrastructure. You know, I remember a treasury official saying to me that nobody would ever use the Jubilee Line extension because who'd ever heard of Surrey Quays or Canada Water, or, you know, and wasn't North Greenwich just a piece of contaminated old gas works? And of course it was full to bursting on day one, never mind as it is now. We're still in a situation now where, despite the overwhelming evidence that London's burgeoning, that the number of people living here by 2020 will be bigger than it's ever been in the city's entire history, we know what is needed in terms of infrastructure, and we're not delivering it fast enough. In this exhibition, a great exhibition at the NLA, on planes and trains and drains, there's a quotation which is that planning these projects has reached elephantine proportions in terms of length of time and delay, and that's just about it. That we spent, for example, 3.5 years just getting a parliamentary consent for Crossrail. That's partly because in a linear asset you don't have one local authority dealing with it, you've got to deal with the numbers, so you use this other procedure. But it's incredibly long-winded. The Parliamentary Bill Committee sits once a fortnight or once a week at most. It doesn't sit at all during recesses. So something that should frankly taken no longer than 1 year has taken 3.5. I wonder how long HS2 is going to take when that bill comes before Parliament. First of all, it'll take years to get it there, and then we're going to take literally 3-4 years to actually just give the scheme consent. You know, nowhere else in the developed world does it like that. And we don't have to do it like that either. But the real issue is just to look at ways in which, consistent with perfectly reasonable democracy, we can actually simply speed up a process.
I'm Debbie Whitfield. I'm the director of NLA, which is London Centre for the Built Environment.
And what's happening tonight? What's starting today?
We're opening the latest exhibition that we've curated, which is all about London's booming infrastructure business. So it's planes, drains and trains, and it's essentially looking across everything that's going on in infrastructure in London.
And what do you hope to achieve with an exhibition like this? It's quite easy for it to kind of almost be overwhelming. There's so much going on in London, there's so many different aspects to it. What are you hoping to teach people?
Well, I guess one of the principal things is literally the act of pulling together in one place everything that's going on in infrastructure at this point in time is a very useful exercise in itself. People often aren't aware of the scale of what's going on, and infrastructure is one of those topics that perhaps isn't quite as sexy or as accessible as some of the other topics that we cover here, like housing and workplace design and so on. So I think just that very act of pulling it all together, seeing the scale of the projects that are taking place and really the complexity of them, one of the things that's been really exciting about pulling the exhibition together is the quality of the visual material that we've got here. There's incredible photographs showing the sheer scale and complexity of projects like Crossrail, like building the Lee Tunnel, which I just don't think people are aware of because they're happening largely underground.
So you're showcasing some of the very best in terms of infrastructure. What would you say to someone who is a designer, an architect, a planner, someone perhaps who doesn't know the ins and outs of these really big scale projects? Is it a closed shop? Do you think there's still plenty of opportunities? Is there still a bright, rosy future for design of infrastructure in London?
I think absolutely. I mean, we have huge challenges being set by the Mayor's Office and the London Plan to really transform the sustainability of London. Things like ensuring that all of our waste is dealt with within the confines of the M25 by, I think it's something like 2031. That poses massive challenges for actually building things that don't sound at all sexy, like waste facilities, but into the urban fabric of the city. And I think, you know, that might be actually quite a small facility at the end of a road, a residential street, and that poses a really interesting design challenge for potentially even quite a small architect.
My name is Roger Hawkins. I'm an architect. My practice is called Hawkins Brown. We've been involved in a variety of infrastructure projects in London for over 20 years. In fact, we've just been listening to Steve Norris talking about how long infrastructure projects take to be developed. And I'm reminded of the fact that I've been working on Crossrail for 21 years on the same site, which is Tottenham Court Road Underground Station. Tottenham Court Road is a very complicated station. It deals with potentially 200,000 people a day, which is a lot of people, and it's in a very tight area. The existing ticket hall for Tottenham Court Road Underground Station exists under a road junction between Oxford Street and Tottenham Court Road leading down to Charing Cross Road. Essentially, it connected two earlier underground stations. The Northern Line and the Central Line used to be only interconnected by crossing at street level. So in the 20s, they joined the two stations together and made the ticket hall now. It's not really fit for purpose. If anyone uses Tottenham Court Road Station, they realise it's often closed down through the congestion. What we're seeking to do is to increase the size of the ticket hall by about fivefold. And that will have a lot of benefits in terms of passenger experience, but it will also make the station easier to operate and manage. Our role as architects has evolved from being creative thinkers in the early process about how space might work and the consultation you might have to do with local people to understand how the station comes together, through the engineering phase when we're working hand in hand, the look and the feel of the station, and now it's about construction delivery. And to a certain extent, I think as architects we're trying to hang on to the design to make sure that, you know, design is kept on the agenda, because these are very big projects, and you know, they are really contractor and engineering led. And if it wasn't for the architect and the design team to keep reminding people that you do have to think about passengers and you do have to think about the quality of materials and experience. Lord Foster, who's a well-known architect, obviously often describes this as putting lipstick on the gorilla. I think I would argue that our experience over 21 years has been taming the gorilla from the outset, so that we're working in collaboration with the gorilla.
So you can put the lipstick on, otherwise he wouldn't let you put it on.
And that was Roger Hawkins talking to Monocle's David Pleasant there. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Section D. Up next, we'll be hearing how Russian luxury house Fabergé is taking its eggs to the skies in a new collaboration.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D. Coinciding with Easter, Russian jewellery brand Fabergé has teamed up with luxury aviation company VistaJet on Egg Miles, a special project in celebration of spring. Fabergé commissioned Turner Prize-nominated artist Ian Davenport to create an exclusive design for the tail of a VistaJet plane. As part of the project, VistaJet passengers will be able to purchase a limited edition collection of Fabergé fine jewellery egg pendants in cabin for a period of 3 weeks. Our associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, sat down with Fabergé's creative and managing director, Katarina Flohr, to learn more about the collaboration.
The synergies between VistaJet and Fabergé came across as we were brainstorming actually within the family, and my daughter Nina said, well, look, you actually are looking at the same clients, and let's do something that could commemorate and celebrate Easter in a way also that tells the story of the evolution of VistaJet, obviously having just accomplished the largest deal, the greatest deal in aviation history. And let's celebrate. How can we celebrate? So we said, well, a celebration, obviously, we're always to give eggs at Easter. And not only that, whilst doing the research for the Fabergé jewellery and going through the archives, we found an album that was created by Ksenia Romanov, the sister of Nicholas II, and she drew each egg pendant that she had been given during the course of several years, and we found that they were always a commemoration, a celebration of an occasion, an event, an anniversary, and so we said, well, the egg is the perfect celebration vehicle. So not only is Easter approaching, so we said, let's celebrate. So how do we do that? What combines both the ethos of VistaJet and Fabergé is the art of the attention to detail, making the passengers and customers feel at ease, inspired, and giving them a really, really wonderful experience. So we felt that as Fabergé is once again about creating the art of making beautiful things, let's tie it together. And of course, we love contemporary art. We've worked with artists both on the VistaJet and the Fabergé side. So we chose Ian Davenport, who is a Turner Prize nominated contemporary artist, for his colourful palette of paintings. And he interpreted the very traditional Fabergé guilloché wave pattern, which was an engine turn pattern applied to, amongst others, the Imperial eggs, in a very contemporary way, because it has to be for today. It has to appeal for customers today. And so we said that we were going to celebrate Easter with this project together. And actually, the idea to choose Ian came from Nina, who said, I've seen this artist's work. What do you think? And so we decided to approach him. And it was quite a meeting, because we came to his gallery and said, well, we want to talk to you about eggs and airplanes, not your obvious project. He was incredibly passionate and enthusiastic. And I think, like all of these projects, you know, you have to get all the ingredients together. And if everyone is thrilled to be part of it, it works. We pulled this whole project off in just under 6 weeks. And we are now offering a selection of Fabergé egg pendants exclusively to VistaJet customers for the duration of Easter on a select number of flights, and obviously to commemorate the story we have created, obviously the artwork for the tail of this brand new Global Express, which is literally just basically hot off the manufacturing. So there's a bit of excitement and buzz around it, maybe very much in the style of, or a little bit in the style of, the Imperial eggs that Peter Carl Fabergé presented to the Romanov family. So once again, in our time, we've taken that sort of excitement evolving around the creation of a jewel to today's time. And we believe that if Peter Carl Fabergé were alive today, he might be amused and hopefully love the way the eggs are obviously taking to the sky.
You are a global company, and it's, let's be honest, Fabergé is not only about eggs. So can you tell me, which markets are we talking about? Which are the growing markets that you are targeting also?
A very important market for us is, of course, Europe. Still Europe and the Middle East, absolutely. The Middle East, very important. Dubai, Doha, I'm visiting Saudi, I'm going to Riyadh and to Jeddah. Another important market is Hong Kong, of course, very important, and Kiev, actually, the Ukraine, and parts of Africa as well. So traditionally, of course, Europe is very important. We've set up in the US as well. I've personally just been to Dubai, and I'm going to Doha and to Riyadh, places I'm very excited about. And we've historically made magnificent sales and found homes for some of the most beautiful pieces that we've created. So I feel very, very passionate and very excited about the Middle East and the appreciation and the sensibility of the customer for objet d'art and for creations of heirloom value and just beautiful artistic interpretations of Fabergé objects today.
And speaking of design specifically, is there something new that you're working on?
Well, we have a collaboration now with Gemfields, which is our sister company with whom we've just merged. So we're looking at creating an abundance of jewels and new products based on colored gemstones, so mainly emeralds, sapphires, and rubies. And we are presenting some of the first pieces in Basel this year at the Jewelry Fair. And we're looking to expand those over the course of the next 12 months. So we will very heavily be looking into designing those and also bespoke commissions, something that's increasingly important for us. We get a lot of feedback from our high-end customers for bespoke creations and even looking into bespoke egg objects. So that's something that we're developing over the course of the next years. And of course, select collaborations with artists and artist jewelers. More to be announced over the course of the next month.
That was Katharina Flohr, Fabergé's creative and managing director, talking to our own Nelly Gochiva there. And back on land, round the corner from Midori House, final details are being taken care of before the brand new Monocle Cafe throws open its doors to the public. I trotted off in search of the creative brains behind the project. Monocle's senior designer, Yoshitsugu Takagi. He joined me by the cake counter to talk me through the design.
This was designed by Monocle design department, but we commissioned London-based Japanese builders who are called Edo Design and Constructions. And they've done an amazing job to build it this beautifully.
They have done a wonderful job. It's a beautiful slatted. Is it red oak?
It is red American oak.
Red American oak. And it's lucky that we had a team of brilliant Japanese designers and joiners relatively close to the office, isn't it? How did you find them?
I knew that they were working in London through my friends. And I always wanted to get in touch with them somehow for related businesses, but fortunately we had this amazing opportunity opening cafe, and I'm so very excited with their completion of the job.
And so we're walking through here, and this is the ground floor, which is quite long and narrow. We have some beautiful tables and chairs from Tasmania, is that right?
That's right, Tasmanian oak tables and stools.
And through into the back room, which again, it's like entering a little bit of Japan. Here, this is sofa and low ottomans by Truck, who are based in Osaka, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Tell us a little bit about this beautiful wooden shelving that we have here and what's going to be displayed on there.
So we have a beautiful wall-mounted Trescontin oak shelves in the back rear room. We are going to display our back issues as well as selected magazines.
Something to be flicking through while you enjoy your coffee. Very nice. And Trescontin is a Danish woodworking firm, is that right?
They are Danish, that's right, yes.
So upstairs people will sit and enjoy their food and read magazines and things. We'll be doing a bit of radio broadcasting. But then downstairs is a little bit more here.
I like this.
Yeah, I love the stairs too. And the stairs were original.
But these, that's right.
Yeah, the handrails were by Edo as well, presumably. And this is beautiful. So this is more like a sort of traditional restaurant layout, maybe where people might enjoy lunch and things.
Exactly. I think the idea is that we keep our basement for subscribers reservations and morning business meetings, etc., etc., but something a little bit more exclusive used.
Okay, and I can see a very nice new Epson projector at the back with a retractable screen that can come down. Unlike most cafes, it's not something hideous and big that you might notice first. Presumably that's for business meetings and conferences and things that people might want to take over this floor for.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes.
And this is beautiful Urkel second-hand tables and chairs.
Yes, our friend from Century, he spent a couple of weeks sorting out all this furniture selection for us.
Where are these lovely lantern lights from?
They are from a company called Leklinkt, and they are Danish too.
So it's a nice mixture of Danish, English, Japanese.
Exactly. That's the best combinations, we believe.
And on the wall, we have a lot of very nice sort of archive pictures from the magazine too. That looks like the hard work of Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto.
That's right, yes. So this is going to be her ongoing project to update pictures, maybe monthly or seasonally.
Very nice indeed. It's just keeping regular visitors to the cafe in touch with what we're doing in Monocle. And then through these beautiful screens as well at one end, we have the small kitchen where food will be prepared.
That's right, yeah. So we have a visible kitchen that's through the screen, slat screen. So a nice smell will come out of this kitchen. And yes, yeah.
What kind of things will be served?
I think the menus are to be confirmed, or we change menus every time to time, but we'll definitely be offering some nice morning breakfast, toast and eggs, I think.
Toast and eggs, and maybe the odd toasted sandwich as well at lunchtime?
Definitely, yes, I think so.
And some salads too, I hear.
I think so. Nice salads for lunch and... Yeah. I even think maybe like late afternoon we have some sort of like early dinner menus too.
Nice. I can see also in the window that we have applied for a license to be able to serve alcohol. So no doubt after a few beers, maybe that projector at the end of the room might be used for karaoke every now and then.
That would be amazing. That's our favourite activity.
That was Monocle's senior designer Yoshitsugu Takagi talking me through the design of the beautiful new Monocle Cafe at number 18 Chiltern Street. Do pop by from this coming weekend to sample it for yourselves. And before we bid you farewell, time for a quick studio tour. This week we knocked on the door of London-based designer Martin Brudnitsky, who talked us through the flesh and bones of his beautiful practice.
My studio is in Chelsea on Lodz Road. It's a great area because, you know, you have a lot of sort of interior design based shops here. In terms of, you have Chelsea Harbour, where you have all the fabrics, materials, you have the auction houses, and it's Chelsea, the epicenter of the universe. Basically, the space we're in now was actually three workshops. It was divided up into three workshops, and basically those tenants left, and we had to do quite a lot of work to make it into a habitable office. It's a fairly large space, but when they divided it up because of these sort of iron cast column structures here, it was like very long and thin, and it was almost difficult to figure out what it would feel like once it was done. And it was actually almost like a surprise because the space is pretty amazing. So the way, and actually we're actually going to do a refurb to this office now because it's about time after 5 years. The office is simple, it's white painted. It has the most amazing sort of industrial metal columns that sort of sit throughout the space, which sort of is really the feature of the space. And then we have basically placed people on large tables. So people sit around tables, so you face each other, which is how we prefer people to work, you know, because design is about communication at the end of the day. Otherwise, it's fairly simple, but as I said, it needs a bit of a refresh. We have in the last year taken on some more space that is not part of this space, that is on another floor in this building. So the main space is basically the design studio where the designer sits. So there's two large teams, each has a director and two associates, and then designers and junior designers and what's called FF&E designers, people who deal with furniture and fabrics, etc. And then in another part of the building, where I sit with my managing director and the whole finance team, and the marketing team sits in a different part of the building. Of course, the business has grown and the space is not really, the space that we had is not large enough anymore. But there was nowhere else to expand into, so we had to take new spaces. I think this building inspires me because it is an old, it was an old warehouse, and it's really decrepit, and that's what I love about it. It's sort of like, it almost looks like it's falling apart, but there's a charm about that that I'm quite attracted to. Other things that I love, but there's two sculptures that I have in the meeting room, one green and one red one, that actually I bought in Costa Rica by this artist, and it's basically just pieces of stone painted in color, spray painted in color, and then glued together. But it's incredibly beautiful.
That was London designer Martin Brudnitsky in his studio there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be coming to you live from the Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair in Milan. As well as Section D, we'll be hosting The Briefing on Monocle 24, live from a different venue each day on Monday the 8th of April through to Wednesday the 10th, bringing you a host of news and views and great guests. That's at 1300 hours Central European time, midday London time. Do tune in to hear all the fun of the fair. This week's show was produced by Alid John and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and I'll leave you this week with a song carefully chosen by Martin Brudnitsky. Here's Outro Lugar by Tocco. Deixar cair. Um dia vem.